Peter just tells us, I mean, you know, young men can become a little overly confident, a little conceited, you know. Most teenagers think they know everything, but them young teenage boys are particularly, boy, they just got it all figured out. So we see those instructions there. So we've got instructions in the New Testament, you know, to look to those who have gone on before us, who have been laboring for the Lord 10, 20, 30, 40 years, been doing this. You know, they've been meeting with people for a long time. They kind of know what works and what doesn't work. You know, and not that you have to pattern everything after them. You're kind of free to go out there and kind of, through your own personality, kind of figure out what this thing looks like, how to share the gospel and to encourage others. But you might save yourself a lot of headache and a lot of time if maybe you take a little bit of advice from those who have gone on before you. So, yeah. Any, just some initial comments on Mark, who's also called John Mark, some things we see from him in the book of Acts, and just a little bit of introductory notes. Are there any other comments or questions on any of that? Okay. Let's speed through this next section. I'm going to take us to Mark chapter 7. Yeah, I think I'm going to cover a couple things here. Who's the primary intended audience of this gospel account? Who was the primary intended audience for Matthew's gospel account? The Jews. So there's your big hint. Who do we think would be the primary intended audience for Mark's account? And then why? It would be the Gentiles. Couple things that I think jump out to me that support that. Mark's definition of Jewish traditions and terms, and we covered that last week. When we were showing that Matthew's intended audience was the Jews, we actually compared some accounts with Matthew and the Gospel of John, showing that Matthew just speaks and refers to customs and traditions as if his Jewish customs and traditions, as if his audience would understand that. And when you read Mark, you see he's a little more similar in John, and that he does take the time to define his terms. Okay? A couple examples of this. Mark chapter 7, verse 1. The Pharisees and some of the scribes gathered around him. When they had come from Jerusalem and had seen that some of his disciples were eating their hands, bread, oh boy, eating their bread with impure hands, that is unwashed. And now we've got the parentheses, right? And so this is where, if you really want to sound smart, which you probably shouldn't want to, that's a parenthetical statement, right? So he's inserting this. And he says, for the Pharisees and all the Jews who do not eat unless they have carefully washed their hands, thus observing the traditions of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they've cleansed themselves. And there are many other things which they received in order to observe, such as the washing of cups, pitchers, copper pots. Okay. So if that was written with the intended audience of being Jewish, it would be a little superfluous, right, to add that statement in there. And this is all over the Gospel of Mark. It's actually another one here in chapter 7 that jumped out to me originally. If you look in verse 10, it says, Moses said, honor your father and mother, and he who speaks evil of father or mother is to be put to death. But you say, if a man says to his father or mother, whatever I have that would help you is Corban, and then he says, that is to say, given to God, you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or mother, thus invalidating the word of God. So when you read Matthew's account, because Matthew has this story in his account, I mean, he doesn't call it Corban. Mark gives it the title for the Jewish custom. So what's happening here is you're supposed to honor your father and mother, supposed to help them. But there was a way that if you were giving money to the temple, you could weasel your way out of fulfilling your responsibility to mom and dad, saying, well, you know, could help you with groceries. Oh, well, you know, could help you with rent. but I've tithed this quarter. And what I have, I've given to God. And and so that was their out. And Jesus is calling their hypocrisy. But what we want to see is he's further explaining what's happening here. Matthew doesn't do that. Okay? Now, what we also see in verse 11, and then I want to hit a few more examples of this, is there are existences throughout the Greek New Testament where Aramaic language is used. And if you do a little digging, the majority of these words are going to have Chaldees descent, okay? Because the Arameans, okay, spoke Aramaic, and that language came through. And the Hebrew people, to a certain degree, although they spoke Hebrew, would understand Aramaic. Now, your Roman is speaking what? Okay, Latin, all right? Greek's starting to kind of fade out here, but they're speaking Latin, and Aramaic's going to be kind of like a foreign tongue to them, okay? So, Corban is actually an Aramaic term, all right? So now, not only in chapter 7 do we see Mark explaining the customs and the traditions of the Jewish people, because a Gentile audience would need that, but he's also taking in verse 11 an Aramaic word and explaining what it means. Because again, the Gentile audience, the majority of them, wouldn't know that right away. Chapter 3, I'd like to hit a few more of these. There are many more, but give us a few examples here. And I still to this day can't say this word. Okay, so in my humility, hopefully it helps you to know it's okay. Okay, I had a Bible study this week. Someone said, well, you know, I just got to be honest with you. I've read through my Bible 2 times. I'm on my track to get through it the 3rd time. And I still can't figure out them names in the Old Testament. And I said, it's okay. All right. But in chapter 3, verse 17, it says, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to them he gave the name... Oh boy. Someone confident in that one? Boanerges. Okay. Better than I would have done. Which means sons of thunder. You ever heard that before? Of course you have. Okay. But that's an Aramaic word. And so John Mark is explaining what Boanerges, okay, means. All right. Sons of thunder. Chapter 5. Just so you guys see this. Verse 41, taking the child by the hand, he said to her, Talitha cum, now we've got the parenthetical statement, right? Which translated means, little girl, I say to you, get up. Always amazed me that those two seemingly words mean all of that, right? But again, another example of that. Final example here, back in chapter 7. I'll let you guys try again. Mark chapter 7, verse 34. And looking up to heaven with a deep sigh, he said to him, we got back-to-back F sounds, so I mean, you figure that one out, right? I mean, I see that word and I just go, Ephratha, right? But that's not what it says. So, Ephratha, okay? But again, that is... be open. So he's taking the time to explain these things. That lets us know. Okay. And you're gonna find a lot more. There are Aramaic words in the Gospels. There's Aramaic in the Old Testament, you guys. It's in Daniel, it's in Jeremiah. But you're gonna see a lot of it concentrated in the Gospel of Mark. Okay, not a ton, but I probably got about half of them just this evening. So, okay. Any thoughts or comments on that? The intended audience and other ways of understanding that? Yeah, pretty straightforward. Okay, Mark chapter 1, kind of debated covering this, but in the very last second decided it would be worth our time. The very first verse of the book is quite telling. The question is, what do we learn from it? And if we don't have any hands right away, I'll give you a hint, okay? Mark 1:1, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. I'll accept 2 answers and then elaborate on one. Okay, so Kevin says Son of God is going to be a theme. Okay, but we saw that in Matthew. And John goes to great lengths to communicate Jesus' divinity. So instead of covering that in detail, because I didn't think that that was unique to Mark, more so than the other gospels, but showing Jesus' divinity was important to the Gentile audience, the Son of God. What else do we see in verse 1 that would be super telling? the beginning of the gospel. Now, why would that be telling? Why would that be important? It's still ongoing. Absolutely. Your hint was going to be Acts chapter 1. Let's turn there. Getting a little ahead of myself for the gospel of Luke, but I do want us to see this. Acts chapter 1, verse 1. The first account I composed, Theophilus, about all Jesus began to do and teach. This agrees with Mark, and it agrees with the two-part that Luke writes, and it tells us that Acts and the church age is Jesus' continued ministry of the gospel. And that, so to speak, the work was finished on the cross, okay? Jesus' let's say, physical ministry, yes, maybe, that he had fulfilled the purpose for which he was sent, but Jesus' ministry, the message of the gospel, and that it saves, continues on through the book of Acts, and the gospel's just the beginning part of that. Go ahead. Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, that's our next point. So, yeah, Lorenzo said it's interesting because it talks about the beginning of Jesus' ministry, skipping right over his birth, right? I believe that is intentional. So, yeah, so just to make sure that we covered that point sufficiently, the Gospels are just the beginning of what Jesus began to do and teach. Right, that's reinforced Luke in the book of Acts, and that the rest of that teaching, the pattern for the assemblies, right? How about the structure of the Lord's body, the appointment of elders, church leadership, purpose and function and form of the church? All these things largely found in the book of Acts and in the New Testament epistles, while the book of Acts is being carried out. So that lets us know. Because people like to play games, right? They really like John, but they'd like to skip Acts, right? Because doctrine starts to really get nailed down in the book of Acts. And so, people like to play games. And this shows us that all of it, okay, is Jesus' teaching. The gospel was just the beginning. To Lorenzo's point here, I don't know. Let me ask you guys. No show of hands. I hope you guys read Mark this week. Mark makes its way into the group of the three synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and that they're similar. But Mark's kind of different, isn't it? I'm going to say feel, so hold on to your seat backs. Get your tray tables back into their upright and locked position, okay? But what's the general feel when you read through Gospel of Mark like that in a week or two? Brad? Ho-ho, does he? Doesn't he, right? He gets right to the point. That's exactly what I was thinking. Bang, bang, bang. Did you know, the word immediately is used over 40 times in the gospel? And immediately the Spirit, and immediately they went forth, and immediately he got up, and it was like, bang, bang, and he is just trying to get through the high points where you read John, and John's like taking the time, and this what Jesus spoke, he spoke of the Spirit whom those were to receive who believed in him, but the Spirit had not yet been given because Jesus had not yet been glorified. Mark's not doing that, right? Got a Gentile audience. Persecution at the hands of the Gentiles is getting ramped up, right? We're looking at a late 60s date for this gospel, okay, close to that 70 AD mark, right? And he's trying to convince a group of Gentiles that Jesus is the Son of God. And so he's going to go, and he did, and he did, and he did this, and he did that, and he did this, and he did that, and he, you see that? And that's kind of how that's going to flow. And so he gets right to the point. And going back to, Lorenzo's comment there. The notes say Mark's gospel is action-packed, moving quickly from one event of Christ to another. Mark places priority on the miracles of Jesus, communicating God's divine power at work through him. So, yeah. Any other comments on that topic? Yeah. maybe 1 week to get through it. See, the problem is if I cover this in 1 week, I'm going to throw Kendall's Bible reading plan off in the bulletin. So, yes, Jared, go. That is true.
So, you know, like even in the next section, he's dealing with the paralytic that's been led down. He uses it an opportunity to teach and uses it an opportunity to basically express the fullness of the message. Mm-hmm. So you get very much the essence of Jesus being a teacher, where it's a little different feel in Matthew and, yeah, and even John, and Luke's is different as well. So,
yeah, exactly. A lot of references to Jesus being the teacher, being the rabbi and a teacher. That's absolutely true. So, yeah, any other comments? Yeah, Lorenzo.
I don't know if you had any thoughts on this, but I've heard that this, some people have even gone as far as to refer to this gospel as being Peter's, because Mark was so much younger, you know, during Jesus's ministry, they, I guess, is assumed. And so he would have got a lot of these details through the, obviously, the apostles, but through Peter's own personal story.
Yeah. Let's go back to Acts chapter 12. We read 1 Peter, where Peter calls him his son. And that shows us that they were close. I want to back up here and grab a little context here in Acts chapter 12. Peter's in jail. Angel of the Lord shows up. Shackles fall off. And Pete heads back home. And in verse 11 it says, Peter came to him and saying, "Now I know for sure that the Lord has sent forth his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all the Jewish people who were expecting." And when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who was also called Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. And when he knocked at the door, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. So the general idea there, Lorenzo, is that when you piece that together with Peter calling him as a son, and this interaction here, the assumption is made, and with his workings with Peter, that he would have been taught quite a bit there in that moment and would have spent a lot of time learning about Jesus from Peter. What I'm going to say is I've read the two verses to you. You figure it out for yourself. I don't think you can nail that down. I have heard that before, and I believe I've heard that in this assembly, maybe like a long, long time ago, that Peter could have been the author there. I can't remember if that came up, Jared, in your class when we were doing Acts, if you care to comment. I would say it's a little tough to nail down and maybe a little bit of a stretch, but yeah. Any other comments on maybe, I mean, Mark's writing this, he's attributed to the author, but you know, really Peter's got a lot to do with it. Any other comments on that? Jared, yeah, I'll come grab you. I'm trying to, you know, stretch this out a little bit, you know.
There are secular writings from some of the what's called the early church fathers that would indicate that Peter, while he wasn't the author, he was certainly a huge source of information for John Mark, and that the inspiration to write it came from Peter.
Yeah. And that's where I'm going to land.
Yeah, I don't think you can say that Peter said, "Here, John, write this down."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I believe Lorenzo's comment was that sometimes it gets called Peter's gospel, and I just don't like that. You know, I just personally don't. I think there can be a large amount of influence in there. Always got to be careful how much we're opening ourselves to these secular writings, you know. But at the end of the day, that's where I've landed. Larry.
So it's my understanding, and if you can't nail down 100%, but I'd say 90%, that in Mark 14:51, it says, "A young man was following him wearing nothing but a woolen sheet over his naked body. He seized him, he pulled free sheet and escaped naked." Most people attribute that to Mark. Because, first of all, why would it be in there? You know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. It makes more sense that was. And it says a young man. It fits the age. It fits everything. So that leads credence that, you know, Mark was around. He just didn't get 100%. He didn't get all this just from Pete.
Yeah. Any other comments on that? Yeah. So, yeah. Good insight. Kevin? Okay. Kevin? Yes. Yeah. And so, like I said, I think that's why Acts 12 is important and worth considering, why he would be there and why he would have gone there, right? Absolutely. Had a thought, but I lost it. So, all right. You guys did good. I'll take her back here. And Okay, all right, this is fun. I kind of did this as a side note, literally. Mark chapter 4. Mark is a synoptic gospel. I went ahead and did a little bit of extra homework. I wanted to know, were there any stories, parables, or teachings in Mark that are not in Matthew, Luke, and John? And oddly enough, I only found two. Didn't know if you guys ever done that legwork before, if you even cared. But I thought that was unique. You know, for instance, the teaching in Mark 2:10, if you ever ask the question, if baptism saves, then what about the thief on the cross? You just have to remember Mark 2:10, forgive in. Hebrews 9, change in time. And Hebrews 9 is going to tell you that at a covenant, there's going to be a change in the terms at the changing of time. And Mark 2:10 is going to tell you that Jesus had authority to be forgiven sins. So, I-N apostrophe, not forgiven, but I-N the apostrophe, you know, slang, covering the G, just so that's coming through online clear. So, that stuff's going to be important, but we also have that in the other gospel accounts. Okay, and when I found the parable in Mark that's not in Matthew and in Luke and John, because Matthew highly concentrated with parables, well, that was a really important parable. Mark chapter 4, verse 26 says, "And he was saying, the kingdom of God is like a man who casts seed upon the soil." Hold on. And he goes to bed at night and gets up by day, and the seed sprouts and grows, how he himself does not know. The soil produces crops by itself, first the blade, then the head, then the mature grain in the head. But when the crop permits, he immediately puts in the sickle because the harvest has come. Okay, that is not the parable of the sower. That is the seed grows and ain't nobody know how. And they still haven't figured it out to this day. How them seeds in your cupboard, in your grandmother's cupboard, they've been there for 100 years, you go out and plant them, bang, corn plant. How does it do that? Just lie dormant, right? And then Jesus says it's got to go into the earth and then it dies. You figure that out, okay? Well, nobody has. But what's really cool here is if you piece, and look, I'm not saying a direct connection. What I'm saying Jesus is teaching is that this is what the church is like. I got a really good story, but I'm not sure I can share it. But have you ever seen your life or people you're involved with, their lives come full circle after 40, 50 years, and then they find the Lord? And they ever sit there and scratch your head and be like, man, how did that happen? That's what the church is like, brethren. It's like throwing out a corn seed, and then bang, it's got a plant. And now you got corn to eat. And God's the one who causes the growth. That's what the church is like. But that parable is unique to Mark. Now you go and do a little digging in Joel, and when you find yourself in Joel chapter 3, if you have any kind of, I don't want to say commentary Bible, but any kind of marginalia notes, that's going to send you straight to Revelation chapter 14, because there is a theme about putting in the sickle when the harvest has come. Okay, so there's some Old Testament parallels there that John's working on in the book of Revelation, and we get a little bit of that here. When the harvest is ready, you put in the sickle and you bring forth what has been sown and matured. Now, Mark chapter 8 is the other one. We'll cover this one and then we'll finish up with any comments on either of these two. Mark chapter 8 has me a little interested. I'm gonna pick your guys' brain here because I believe I got this one right. Mark chapter 8, verse 22. When they came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to Jesus and implored him to touch him. Taking the blind man by the hand, he brought him out of the village, and after spitting on his eyes and laying his hands on him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" And he looked up and said, "I see men, for I see them like trees walking around." Makes you wonder if at one time he could see, doesn't it? It didn't say he was born blind. So that's your hint, by the way. I mean, how does he know what men look like in trees? I mean, food for thought. Then again, he laid his hands on his eyes and looked intently and was restored and began to see everything clearly. And he said to him, sent him to his home, saying, "Do not even enter the village." I'm going to take the position that that is only recorded in the Gospel of Mark. Does it sound eerily familiar to another gospel story, though? Where's that one at? Gospel of John. Chapter 9? 8. 9. 8. Yeah. Yeah, John chapter... Yeah, John chapter 8. Because then he goes on and argues with the Jews. His parents kind of, but really don't stick up for him. And that man is healed. Okay? But he's born blind. Now, I'm not saying that because Mark says he was blind, and his words to Jesus is, I see, you know, lumpy dark images like tall trees, that proves he wasn't born blind, and somehow Mark just left that detail out. Remember, Mark gets straight to it. Leaves all sorts of things out, kind of like Jesus' birth, just left out, okay? That doesn't mean it didn't happen, right? So that's not what I'm trying to say. But I very much believe Mark 8's account is very much different. Any ideas why? I've already given you the information in reading it. Has anybody picked up on how we can know these are separate incidences?
Different locations.
Yeah, okay. Kevin, you're in trouble. Different locations. In Mark 8, where is the man healed? Bethsaida. In John 8, John 9, thank you. In John 9, where is he healed?
Pool of
Siloam. Where is Bethsaida geographically? You're done. Y'all got maps in the back? I don't know. Where's Bethsaida? Ooh, Kevin said, yes, absolutely. What does Bethsaida mean?
House of fish.
So where is it? Sea of Galilee, Rain. By the Sea of Galilee. Now, where's the pool of peace? Where's the pool of Siloam? Where's that? Jerusalem. Just outside. I know why I have John 8 on the brain. Go to John chapter 8. I'm in Mark 8. Go to John 8. This is what... Yes! Okay, John chapter 8, the woman caught in adultery is brought to Jesus. Right? Hopefully we remember that story. And in verse 20, these words he spoke in the treasury, as he taught in the temple. All right, now that treasury is going to be in the courtyard of the temple. Okay, the women had access to that. And that lets you know that they're in Jerusalem. Now, the pool of Siloam is also going to help us, but I just wanted to hit some of these points leading up to John chapter 8. And then this is more for a did you know tidbit thing, like there's a reason for this. But if you keep going in John chapter 8, verse 59, after he finishes this discourse with the Jews who are arguing with him, after the woman's brought to him, in verse 59 it says, "Therefore he picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple." So he's in Jerusalem. Then in verse 1 of chapter 9, he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. So these are very different stories. The first part is, yeah, it's a tidbit. I did want to give you a couple stories in the Gospel of Mark that are unique to the Gospel of Mark because that's the overview we're doing, and that's appropriate. But I did notice when studying Mark, I believe in chapter 6 of John 9 here, it refers to Jesus spitting on the ground and then healing him, and then Mark's Gospel is the only other account that records Jesus spitting and using mud to heal people of their deafness and their blindness. So, wanted to show that. That is unique to the Gospel of John primarily. Okay? And the only other place, to my knowledge, where this mixing of mud with spit is used is actually in John chapter 9. And that's why I got doing some digging, because I thought, is there any chance these overlap? And geography gave me the answer. The answer is no. But when you read the prior chapter in Mark to the man being healed of his blindness, you see that Jesus is spitting on everything to cleanse just about every ailment. Okay, so that's unique to the Gospel of Mark. So I've got those written down. closing comments either on those two, the parable of the kingdom being like a seed that's sown and it grows and nobody knows, but when it fully brings maturity, then the sickle. I just thought that was really cool. I got a really good story, and I just had a conversation with a gentleman recently and didn't ask him for permission, but man, it's cool. I mean, you look back on your own life, how things play out, and you answer the call of the Lord, and you obey that call by being immersed in his name, and then people in your life who, I mean, at one time in your life, it was like, man, you know, it's tough to see they're going to say they're going to find the path that leads to righteousness, right? And then it just comes full circle. And man, God was causing that growth the whole time. So that gives me great hope and perseverance. Any other comments on that or anything else, stuff that's jumped out to you as you've been reading through it, through the Gospel of Mark? Go ahead, Brad. Yeah. I mean, the front door wasn't open. Yeah. And I think that rushing, too, I mean, I agree with you, Brad. And it's not just a rushing, it's just getting down to the details because of his audience. I mean, read Matthew, 28 chapters, you know, it's like, a lot of detail in there. John, big gospel. A lot of detail in there, right? But he's just trying to show the Gentile people that Jesus is the Son of God. And if he can show that, then the Gentiles can put their hope and faith and trust that he has the power to save. So that's also going to be a little bit tied in there. So, Lorenzo.
I have a lot of comments.
Well, let's get one tonight and then you save one for next week.
Yeah, that works.
And then, you know, Morgan will remind you what that was.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Yeah, a lot of emphasis in, and not unique to Mark, but the thing we notice about Mark is Jesus' command that if you believe him, to follow him. Those who followed him, sometimes physically, I mean, just followed him everywhere. That language does show up quite a bit in Mark. But also Mark teaches us the requirements to follow Jesus. Okay, now that's not unique to Mark, but you see that theme running through, right? And then Mark's account does call the apostles followers, which I thought was cool. So a lot of emphasis on following Christ and what it takes to follow him. So, yeah, don't forget your other one, okay?